grab your credential. It's time to go inside Press Row with Jordan Breen on the SureDog.com blog.
Welcome inside Press Row. I'm Jordan Breen. It was going to be a rough week for the UFC and Dana White anyway, having to promote UFC 173 with a main event of Hayden Barrow and TJ Dillashaw. Period. This pay-per-view market, this time for the UFC, this was going to be a challenge. Of course, this was before Dana White came out and got in a idiotic, self-generated bitch fest on Twitter with MMA journalist Ben Folks over a reasonable and well-written column, which Dana White clearly didn't read. So here to discuss not just the MMA promoter of greatest repute in the sport not being able or showing little interest in reading, but also the curious place that UFC 173 ends up in when it comes to being promoted in this time in pay-per-view space, is an all-around lovely gentleman of impeccable wit and splendor, the editor of SB Nation's BloodyElbow.com, the inimitable Mr. Nate Wilcox. Nate, when you first hear Hayden Barrow, TJ Dillashaw is your new UFC 173 headliner, walk me through your feels.
Well, you know, historically, Jordan, and this is at Kid Nate on Twitter, let me put a plug in there. Historically, the Memorial Day UFC was one of the big UFCs a year. You had, you know,
one of the big four.
Yeah. You had, you know, New Year's, Super Bowl, Memorial Day, 4th of July, right?
Yes.
And usually they put a big one in the fall, but there wasn't some holiday or anything it was linked to. Now, they haven't been able to string together two out of four of those in a while. But, you know, Weidman versus Belfort, I mean, it wasn't going to be, you know, Lesnar versus Carwin or anything, but it was a pretty hot fight. I mean, if you were following the game, you were like, man, I want to see this. And for casual fans who are in and out, like, they knew who Belfort was, and Weidman's certainly an easy sell. He's the guy who broke Anderson Silva's leg. Oh, yeah, I want to see that guy. But now I'm in the position, you know, I've had some friends who historically have come over to my Memorial Day weekend UFC party, like, hey, are there fights? Yeah, man, it's like one of the best fighters in the world, you know, Hayden Barrow, undefeated bantamweight champion. And they're like, oh, well, cool, man, I'll call you in July, you know, like, they don't want to hear, like, they're like, didn't I see him on WEC, like, for free? Yeah, lots of times he was great. Cool, well, y'all have fun, you know, like, I mean, it's like I was on hold with my ISP the other day for 30 minutes, and the hold ad was, don't miss UFC 173 featuring undefeated champion Renan Barihoo against defensive machine TJ Dillashaw. Don't miss the action. And I'm like,
please tell me they said Hayden Barihoo.
They said Renan Barihoo.
Renan Barihoo, master fisherman.
Yes. I mean, it was like, wow. You know, these are your, I mean, this is admittedly a small ISP. It's not, you know, Time Warner or Comcast or whatever. It's a local competitor. But, you know, that's how they make their money with these pay-per-views. I mean, the profit margins on these things are the best thing the cable companies have going this side of, you know, pay-per-view porn. And they take this stuff serious, and they can't even figure out the dude's name. It's like, and also, defensive machine, TJ Dillashaw. Like,
is that really the tagline?
That's the tagline, man. And they must have got that from the UFC, because how'd they parse that out themselves? You know, like, they can't even figure out how to pronounce the champ's name. And
how do you get that call down from the UFC? You know what I mean? Because I can't fathom it. This is what puzzles me.
You don't sell anything as a defensive machine, man. You don't sell the 73 Dolphins as a defensive machine, you know? You sell them as hard-nosed, face-busting killers, you know? You don't, I mean, it's like, Christ. Come watch a no-hitter. Watch them stand up and step down. There won't be a hit the whole game. Nine long innings of silence. I mean,
it puzzles me even more deeply because We can discuss the actual specific greatnesses of Hayden Barrow. This guy is a pound-for-pound quality fighter. He's beat some good guys at bantamweight. He is a real offensive treat. There's not too many guys in MMA, even at the highest level, that combine exotic one-strike-type knockouts, or at least that versatility of technique, but also can finish guys off in really sassy fashion on the ground. Hayden Barrow is really the complete offensive package, but one of the things that intrigues me about him is, I mean, he was hurt by Michael McDonald. I thought he struggled the opening round against Eddie Wineland. He's been hurt and dropped in the past. TJ Dillashaw is not as good as some of his Team Alpha Male counterparts, but he does hit very hard. Other than Chad Mendez, who just has that natural, juicy, mitted pop, TJ Dillashaw is probably the natural biggest hitter there. That is what's intriguing about him fighting Hayden Barão. He obviously doesn't have a great probable chance at putting together like a 25-minute virtuistic game plan and stealing the belt from Hayden Barão. But he could potentially hit him in the face, knock over the apple cart. Defensive machine. It completely belies the one thing that is interesting about TJ Dillashaw.
Well, the other thing is Brazilian legend Hayden Barão against All American TJ Dillashaw. That's how you sell this shit. Like, what are they talking about? Or they could go the best pound for pound fighter in the game, Hayden Barão, against the slugger who has a chance, I mean, it's like, give him the Ernie Shaver story. Like, what are they doing? Like,
or
everybody,
give him the same story that you give everybody else, even when it's not genuine. Like, TJ Dillashaw does actually have a puncher's slash striker's chance to win this fight in a way that not every UFC challenger does. How is that the message you go? I'm flabbergasted. Not that they screwed up Hayden Barão's name in an amusing way. That's kind of what they expect, especially from a local charming ISP. But you said defensive machine, right?
A defensive machine. Like, what? Yeah, it's like guy you've never heard of against guy who will bore the pants off you. 55-95. Like, come on, man. That's not how you sell anything. I mean, it's like going to the soda shop and getting, here's a can of diabetes. I mean, it's like, that's not the sales pitch.
No, you put Shaq's face on it.
Yeah.
Have you seen any of the Arizona Shaq sodas?
I have not, man.
Don't let your kids have one. They're like 400 calories for one of the Arizona tall boys. Like, those things will give you the beatus in a hurry. You'll just have your eyelids quivering in a real sugary in a sugary seizure in no time flat. Let's get to the larger question here. And this is not unique to MMA or the UFC or Hayden Barão. There's lots of people that there's like an ongoing sense of, all right, this fighter is brilliant. They're exciting to watch. They beat very good fighters. They're the best in their weight class. How do we get people interested? Hayden Barão is an even more profound example because he's got a personality but doesn't speak English. And he doesn't really have any interesting foils. I think bantamweight's probably the weakest division in the UFC right now just because it's the most stagnant. Middleweight was the bastard division for years, but 185 is red hot right now. It's arguably the most interesting division in the UFC outside of lightweight and welterweight. 135 is really the one that's slowed up. I mean, on the women's side, it's more interesting than the men's side.
Yeah, for sure. Flyweight, I think, is pretty logjam too. There's sucking wind uphill in a number of angles. I mean, remember, it took him a long while to be able to sell Anderson Silva. I mean, there was a long period of time when Dana White was screaming, this is the best pound for pound fighter in the world. I mean, it was arguably true, arguably wasn't, but it was a damn good case, and he was capable of such amazing performances, and yet he wasn't really connecting with people until he really had the foil with Chael Sonnen, and Chael Sonnen pushed him. And it made it, like, nobody wants to see a guy they don't care about get an easy win, like, especially when they're dancing around like Anderson Silva was at UFC 110 against Maya, or, the tallest latest fiasco that, the Patrick Cote disaster.
UFC 112 against Demian Maya, by the way. Keep your facts straight.
I thought I said 112.
110, buddy. 110.
Oh. Sorry, man. I've got a proper noun problem. I'll literally sit there and be saying Kansas. Kansas. No, I mean Kansas. And they mean, you mean Texas. Oh, yeah, yeah. Cool.
That one, with the AS.
So forgive my senescent brain there on the numbers. I was literally, I said that and I was like, I got that number right. No problem. UFC is ingrained in my memory because it was such a long, grueling fiasco. Anyway, so it's not unheard of to have a problem selling a great athlete, and that's fighting sports. Young guys at their peak don't become superstars until generally, that happens with boxer after boxer. Sugar Ray Leonard wasn't a huge megastar when he was at his athletic peak. He was a huge megastar, frankly, a few years after he was past his prime. And that's, you know, same things happen with Anderson Silva, it seems like. And so I'm not surprised by that, but the UFC's kind of trained us to expect the lightweight divisions for the lighter weight divisions for free. And we've got a lot of champions. Some of my casual friends, like, they can't tell Barao from Jose Aldo, you know. Oh, is this Aldo Jr.?
Time's an important factor, and one that I think people constantly underestimate. Like, you brought up the Sugar Ray Leonard example. I mean, we can go countless examples in MMA. I mean, George St. Pierre had, like, a grassroots, like, he, like, people were interested in him by the time he fought Hughes the first time. But it was a steady incremental build towards him being a star. The Anderson Silva one that you mentioned is a brilliant one because he was champion for years before he finally had that resonance, whether, you know, people just finally caught on, or it was the Chael Sonnen push, or it was the Chael Sonnen push in conjunction with him smashing his foot through Vitor Belfort's face. Whatever the recipe was, it finally clicked, but it takes time. And I remember when Quentin Jackson beat Chuck Liddell, and people instantly start screaming, oh my God, they're not promoting Quentin. He's their new champion. How could they do this? And it's like, well, he just won the title. Then he fought Dan Henderson and broke his hand. It's like, what are they supposed to do? How much stuff do you think they can do when this guy's had one fight? And then obviously he blew it against Forrest Griffin after the infamous throwdown energy drink inspired monster truck tirade through Orange County. So, like, the actual part of having to go out, defend your title a couple times, go through the process, do all the media stuff, and the cumulative effect that that can have on your star power, that is something that's underrated. And I think it can often be harder for smaller fighters because each time out, there's less and less chance that you're going to get a major star. I mean, Hayden Browse already fought Uriah Faber twice. He's not going to get to fight someone more known in that weight class or that weight range than Uriah Faber already. But when it comes to the idea of, you know, oh, this guy's great, people have really only accepted Hayden Barao's, you know, godliness or greatness for a year or so. The first Faber fight where he ripped him up, that was, you know, going on 2 years ago. Since then, he had the McDonald fight, the Wineland fight, and then the relatively pointless Faber rematch. I mean, he was impressive in all of them. Three stoppages in his last three fights, whatever you might think of Herb Dean's terrible stoppage at UFC 169 in the Faber rematch. But three fights, albeit three impressive finishes, that's not necessarily enough. It's great that he got three fights in basically a 12-month span. Lots of champs don't do that. But the Michael McDonald fight was a small European card. Jones Gustafson, he got, you know, a richer treatment. But even though that Super Bowl weekend card was, you know, 69, as we mentioned, this is not exactly this isn't your father's UFC, as indicated by this Memorial Day weekend card. Just because something falls on the Super Bowl weekend, Memorial Day weekend, Independence Day weekend, New Year's Eve weekend season doesn't mean it's going to be the biggest main event in the world. Barao really actually hasn't had the chance to shine the way that, even if you're someone that truly is a rose-colored glasses type optimist and you believe that if you build it, they'll come, and if enough people just see Hayden Barao eventually, magnetism will take over. Even if you truly believe that in whole, we're talking about basically three fights having a belt around his waist and not the greatest profile possible. I don't know if Hayden Barao can be a star. I don't know if he can be a star in Brazil. But for people to talk about it like it's just, you know, if it's going to happen, it's got to happen right now. The actual gestation period this guy's had to try to become a star is extremely short when we look at, you know, historical precedent.
For sure, for sure. But, you know, Dana's flip out on Ben Foulkes yesterday, while highly entertaining. Classic Dana. But it also, I wouldn't really call it like vintage Dana. I think Dana at his best would have been able to roll with the punches because he would have been more confident about his product. I mean, Dana squeals, you know, when he's hurting.
Dana at his best might have been able to at least read the first two or three paragraphs and understand what Ben Foulkes was trying to write, rather than reading the lead paragraph and just going off about what he imagined the piece might say.
Yeah, like if I had done a headline, if I had just had the energy and time to do the Renan Berryhew headline I wanted to do after hearing my cable ad, I could see Dana jumping my ship for that. And that would have been great. Totally fair, no matter what the subject of the article was, you know. But not even getting the point. I mean, it's like Dana knows this is a bad, this is not a big, a good package. And he knows Bellator just stole his thunder last weekend. I mean, I was pleasantly, I mean, the Bellator pay-per-view was a fiasco, but it had Tito and Rampage and drama and King Mo calling Bjorn a dick rider. And, you know, it had people buzzing and clicking on sites. I don't know how many pay-per-views.
Let's say this. UFC 160 or 173 this weekend, legitimately, it could be a banging card. You know, we got some stuff on the undercard that could provide.
There could be a lot of great action on it. And there's a couple of fights.
The main card of this got some bangers. Like, really? Jamie Varner and James Krause aren't going to get the night popping?
But seriously, dude, James Krause is opening up the pay-per-view? Like, the guy's like one fight away from getting canned, or would be. I mean, it's just like...
Why? Hang on. Why is James Krause one fight away? Look, okay, the Bobby Green thing was ridiculous. But other than that, that's his only loss in forever. I mean, excluding the Ultimate Fighter, you know, when he got knocked out by Justin Lawrence or whoever it was. He's still not that long away from trashing Sam Stowe, getting his way back to the UFC. James Krause, in spite of that body kick foolishness with Bobby Green, Steve's an entertaining fighter. I like the pairing with him and Jamie Varner, even if he's a righteous.
I'd like it fine on the FS1 part of the card. I just don't see it as a pay-per-view. Yeah, fuck it. I looked at the Wikipedia yesterday and thought for some reason he was 1-3 in his last four fights. I got to tell you, Jordan, I've given up on following the minutia of this sport, and I do this shit for a living. So I have immense sympathy.
You're not alone.
I have immense sympathy for people who are, you know, fans who are trying to have no idea what's going on. And anyway.
So all of that to say, though.
I still don't think James Krause and Jamie Varner is a pay-per-view fight. Like, I mean, that should be a good table setter action-wise, and there's going to be, you know, but the action, the thing is, and the things that fans, you know, that read us when we talk about marketing and stuff don't understand, there's the sporting proposition, is this going to be a good fight? That's a separate conversation from, is this fight card going to sell?
Yeah.
And honestly, you know, you look at Mayweather and his endless success, his fights are rarely even passably good, you know? People don't care about that. They get the personality. They've heard the name. The whole family comes around. They have, you know, barbecue.
Well, Floyd Mayweather fight at this point in time is a cultural event. You know, I always say, you know, and not to force any, like, you know, heteronormative bullshit. I don't want to, like, cop a stance like, well, to be a real man or anything like that. But, like, I'm suspicious and contemptuous. You meet people and they're like, Yeah, I'm into sports or whatever. And it's like you haven't seen a Floyd Mayweather or Manny Pacquiao fight, like, ever? Like, what are you doing? Like, to me, you care about sports. That's a cultural event. The biggest boxers in the world are fighting. How do you not care about this? So from the Floyd Mayweather perspective, I fully understand that a lot of people find him boring and that there's very seldom a serious hope that a fight's going to be competitive, shouts to Marcus Maidana, let alone entertaining, double shouts to Marcus Maidana. I still fully expect people to get into Floyd Mayweather with Mayweather fights, excuse me, because they are, like I said, cultural experiences.
Because he's on the tail end of his career, and he's been the champ for a long time. Like I was saying earlier, there's been that time to get the word out. And there just hasn't been the time to get the word out. And for Dana to act like, oh, you're so stupid if you don't know how great Hanan Barao is. I mean, it's like, settle down, Beavis, you know? Like, just chill, dude. It's a different discussion from how good the fighter is to how sellable he is. This is more about, can he speak English? Does he have a personality? Where's his foil? Where's his Chael Sonnen?
Foil's the interesting thing. Like, because the personality thing, like, I'd love to hear deeper takes from someone who speaks the mother tongue. But, like, a lot of times in the whole Barao narrative, I hear people say that, well, you know, well, he doesn't speak English, you know, he doesn't really have a lot of charisma.
You know, the English thing is irrelevant, if I can interrupt, though, because remember, I mean, when I came up in this, loving this game, it was random VHS tapes coming in the mail with a post-it note that said, you know, IVF 8 on it. And then I would watch these fights with no subtitles in a foreign language. I didn't even know the people's names most of the time.
But never mind Pele. That, dude. Look at how people responded to Pride. You know, like the most popular Pride guys.
But just, and frequently people watch those on bootleg streams that were in Japanese and stuff. Wanderlei Silva came across as soon as you saw his face, hit the tattoos, the posture, the way he held his gloves together and flexed his wrist before the fight. the stare down, that guy didn't just have personality, he had persona.
Yeah,
and that's
Vanderlei's probably, I think, the best example ever. Obviously, he morphed into someone who spoke English and could endear all kinds of fans. And hell, Vanderlei's English even became, part of the mystique. You know, if he was a native English speaker, we probably wouldn't have got the all-time most famous Vanderlei Silva line, which is "I promise violence."
Yes, indeed.
I mean, like, have three better words in MMA in conjunction ever been spoken? I promise violence.
That is the sweet stuff. But part of that's not Hanan's fault. Part of that is the way the UFC packages fights and fighters. I mean, Pride could make a star out of less than stellar material.
The UFC doesn't know how to capitalize on quirk. You know what I mean? Like, the UFC, like, when I see Hanan Barral, like, anecdotally, what appeals to me is, like, I don't want to say how normal he seems, but very much just seems like a regular dude or a sort of strange dude with some extraordinary mixed martial arts abilities. There was a UFC recently, and Hanan Barral is sitting there in the crowd. I think it's one of the Brazilian ones. And he had spilled a drink on himself, and, like, his crotch was all wet. And, like, he gives the standard, you know, like, thumbs up to the camera and the fist. And then he, like, points to his crotch, and for, like, the other 5 to 8 awkward seconds where Uriah Faber would normally say "Hi, Mom" 7 times, Hanan Barral just points to his crotch like, "Hey, my crotch's wet. It looks like I pissed myself. Isn't this funny? I poured a drink on myself. I'm a moron. I'm the champion, but I'm a bit of a klutz sometimes."
Yeah, that was
what a weird way to behave on camera. Like,
that's the only Barral gif that I've seen have traction online. Like,
didn't he have, like, a funny dance? Like, I don't think after the Faber one, but after he hit the spinning back kick, chin music on Eddie Wineland.
Yeah,
didn't he
there
do,
was a
like,
couple, but
funky
people weren't
Aldo
talking.
Type
it, but people weren't bringing it back up months later. Like, the Hanan Barral, the pants wetting thing, that gets popped up into the Bloody Elbow comments on the weekly. I mean, that's got a life of its own that none of his – I mean, there were gifts, plenty of gifts. You know, he's been the Zombie Prophet gif of the week, many a fight card. But that gif has life.
I feel like he needs a trademark dance.
I don't – the pants pissing thing maybe, you know. I mean, Ozzy Osbourne made a big virtue out of poor bladder control, apparently, allegedly, I'm told. That's the rumor. But you know how Ozzy's trademark was soaking himself with water, right, on stage? It's because the poor guy had no bladder control. So,
well, I mean, Dana White did let it out of the bag that Hanan Barral is also a master fisherman. Maybe he just needs to combine these two things, the pant pissing and the fact that Dana White, in his haste of typing on his iPhone or his BlackBerry or whatever the hell he uses, typed out that Hanan Barral is a badass who fishes people. Like,
he's a fisher of men, like our Lord and Savior Jordan.
Yeah, dude, this is what I love about it. It seems petty to go and, like, "Oh, you made a typo," but he fishes people.
Yeah.
I just imagine Hanan Barral on a dock with a giant stick and all these 135ers ensnared, their mouths being torn apart by his tackle.
I mean, everybody knows he's on a phone and he's in a hurry, but at the same time, he's got millions of Twitter followers, and frankly, Twitter's the only way he communicates with his audience most of the time. Like, Dana needs to have his shit together. The guy's a pro, you know? Like, I think it's totally fair to call him for a move like that. Like, it's totally fair to rag on me for not knowing shit about James Krause because, you know, it's supposed to be my job. Like, it's supposed to be your job to communicate with people. And I don't expect Dana to be polite or reasonable, but I expect Dana to make a case that sells his fights. Like, the net effect should be, "Hey, man, did you hear the bullshit Dana said? Blah, blah, I disagree, I agree. Hey, when's the fight?" You know? But it seems like more and more, leading up to a Jon Jones fight, Dana White's pushing Ronda Rousey versus Floyd Mayweather. I mean, he's just always just off topic. And when he is on topic, he's counterproductive. It's sad to see somebody that I admire as a hero of the sport and a master of his field as a fight promoter, best fight promoter of our generation, I would say. You know, not the emeritus victory lap level yet, but I can't think of anybody his age that's even comparable. I mean, Oscar De La Hoya has been basically a dud as a fight promoter, and that's the only real peer I would say Dana.
And he's also, I mean, obviously there's a lot of cooks in the kitchen when it comes to the UFC, but Richard Schaefer's the trigger man for Golden Boy. Lorenzo Fertitta still might get say what the UFC does, but Dana White can still fire the gun.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like Don King had other people in his operation, but people remembered who Don King was because he was the guy on camera with the weird hair talking, you know? And that's what I'm talking about, the Carney Barker role. And Dana's been such a master at it, and it just it worries me as somebody who's professionally dependent on this cat's success. I root for Dana White every day, day in, day out, no matter what contempt he has for us and what we do. And when I see him just losing the plot like that, like yesterday, and honestly, the thing yesterday, like nobody really cares about. So, you know, fight promoter barks at a.
No, I mean, really, it's hardcore MMA fans' enjoyment because it reaffirms things we're already aware of.
Yeah.
It gets to the heart of, you know, Dana White's, oh, I don't read the internet, because clearly he doesn't read despite using the internet. And also, it's a story because it's a non-story. You know what I mean? Dana White created out of the ether a personal attack that didn't exist.
It's an unforced error.
And then took a guy to task for it. Yeah, exactly.
And then calls his champ, he fishes guys. Like, you know, like it was of a piece with the Renan Barihu ISP ad, you know? I mean, it all puts together as what Luke Thomas would call promotional malpractice. A phrase I taught Luke Thomas, by the way, that has since become his trademark, but that's fine. And that's, you know, Bloody Elbow is going to have a new feature. We did a post last night, sort of misheadlined it, epic Dana White Twitter meltdown. Like, I okayed that, and then I went back and was like, yeah, let's call that the Dana Tweet of the Week. But from now on, the Dana Tweet of the Week is going to be a regular feature, and it's always going to be tweeted out as Dana White's epic Twitter meltdown. So that's just a promise to those reading.
So some weeks you realize that Dana White's epic Twitter meltdown is just going to be him like going to Pinkberry and causing havoc, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, whatever. It's going to become an in-joke for our small and irrelevant audience of hardcore fans the UFC doesn't care about and actively despises, in fact.
But whatever fishes people.
Exactly. Whatever fishes people.
So I like that. I also like that part of Dana White's, I don't know, invective against Ben Folks there was that, like, oh, yeah, like these journalist guys, they'll say anything for hits.
I know.
as a member of it, as a man who's down in it, I think the MMA media gets a lot of unnecessary flack and shit, but one thing I won't say is that the MMA media is free and innocent of overhyping charges. Like any, you know...
Sure.
There's times the MMA media, you know, by either accepting the UFC narratives or, I don't know, being dazzled by how transparent they are, just get into these weird discussions about them and completely, you know, lose the point about overselling things. You know what I mean? Like, you know, people getting into serious deep conversations about, like, Cormier Cummins. Is it good? Do they really hate each other? Is this really a grudge match? Like, that's a perfect example of just people getting conned and buying the wolf tickets.
Yeah, but I don't, you know, like, it's part of our job to sell the wolf tickets too, and I don't think there's anything wrong with, you know, doing a headline, you know, real heat sizzles between Cormier and Cummins, you know,
I think you always want to grab the headlines, but you want to do it in a way that's at least slightly not so disingenuous. All that said,
you want to train people to click again. You don't want to burn people so bad that they never crying wolf, you know.
Exactly.
You know, and so there's a balance there, and that's just, you know, that's the art. But it's also it's a total trope of the press that we're sleazy hacks just looking to exploit misery and misfortune for profit. Hey, that's the nature of the business, you know. Like, newspaper men are the only people that celebrate a family of five getting hit by a train on Christmas Eve because it was a slow news day. That's the only field and the mortician. But so, okay, we're vultures. I get it. That's fine. You know, that's part of the game. He calls us vultures. We call him a shill, whatever. That's I think that's all above the belt. But he does push it too hard sometimes. Like, that was not what Ben was doing yesterday.
No, and I think that is what is so ridiculous about it, is it's not – of all the Ben Folks stuff you could take umbrage with, really? Like, that's – for a Ben Folks piece, that's pretty uncontroversial. You know what I mean? Like, if Dana White was going to get his panties in a bunch, you figure somehow his BlackBerry would have crossed paths with Ben Folks pieces about how shitty the UFC pay-per-view pacing is or something like that. And that would stick in his craw. Yet, this is something that is really, like, free of critique. You know what I mean? Like,
it was just the headline. And,
exactly.
And because Dana knows that this is a weak pay-per-view. He knows there's there's an outside chance that Bellator will outperform this UFC. And it's
Give me the two numbers that you think make that possible.
Let's say that this UFC is an unprecedented disaster, right? Let's say there's a weather event.
The Bellator pay-per-view.
Well, let's see. The odds are 90% chance it at least doubles the Bellator thing. But, like, we're looking at $350,000 for this shit. Okay, I'm completely – it's outbid by the fucking Bellator is going to do $35,000. This is going to be $350,000. So it's not even close. Forget I said anything. Math is not my forte. But in terms of buzz and hype, there's a real chance the Bellator thing is going to outshine this deal. And that's what Dana doesn't like. That's what Dana's squawking about. I mean, you know, but let's say the UFC has the worst case for this is probably 280, I think. And best case for Bellator is probably 75,000. So that's completely insane and demented. I admit, my bad.
The fact you checked yourself with, you know, decent finger math there and corrected yourself, very charming, Nate. Well done.
Well, thank you. Literally, I it's like I'm sniffing glue. I was all up all night with a 13-month-old crying, and, you know, so I got things.
Hang on. You were up all night with, and TJ, you can run that back if you want, a 13-month-year-old. Ladies and gentlemen, Jacob Tito Wilcox.
That's how tired I am as with my responsibilities as a parent and father. So anyway,
you're so tired with your responsibilities as a parent and father, you're turning into Tito Ortiz.
Exactly. Tito, I want to be a dream of inspiration to inspiring or something.
You were put on this earth as a tool, man.
I was put on this earth as a tool. It's true. We all were, Jordan. We all were. But, I don't know. But the Bellator hype, I think, will – I won't be surprised if my web traffic, which is the metric I watch closely, is very competitive. Bellator did very well vis-a-vis UFC 172, which blew me away. Now, a lot of that is people were interested in Tito and Rampage and not buying the pay-per-view.
Well, the last 90 minutes just ignited it because actual stuff happened. The last three fights on the Bellator card – created just a – that card went from being, oh, this is Bellator's first pay-per-view to this is an event. I will remember Bellator 120 so long as I live.
Yeah.
And it's all because of that last 90 minutes to 2 hours.
It had a mix of great fights, bad judging, high drama. You know, I mean, not that the Rampage Mo fight was even a good fight, but it had high drama. And then the post-fight antics –
exactly.
Oh, my God. You know, and the judging. Oh, my God. You know, and the Chandler Brooks fight was a great fight qua fighting. Then you have this extremely questionable judging decision. Like, when I first watched the fight, I was so fixated that Brooks had made it a competitive fight. When he won, I was like, well, okay, I'm fine with that. Like, but I never was adding up my scorecard because, I mean, Brooks patently got crushed in the last round there and – When I saw the judges' scorecard, I thought initially, okay, they gave him an early round that he didn't deserve. Like, but to give him that fifth round, man, I was just, you know, wow. So anyway, that's Mississippi for you. What are you going to do? But all that narrative of clusterfuck, sometimes a rolling, tumbling clusterfuck, that's what attracts.
Well, here's the thing. It's easy to portray it as like, oh, like you know, the clusterfuck. Oh, everything went wrong, and that's what drove us towards a conversation.
No, but sure, clusterfuck has good mixed with bad, mixed with funny. They had it all.
Well, even if somehow the outcome seemed good for Bellator. The simple fact was, based on the last three outcomes at Bellator 120, with each successive one, the MMA landscape felt different. Like, MMA literally felt different as a sport with Tito Ortiz having beat Alexander Shlemenko.
Exactly. And people seems hard. The loss of Shlemenko, like, Shlemenko took a ding. Like, dude, the best case for Alexander Shlemenko is not even a fraction of the money they can make wringing the Tito Ortiz washcloth for a couple more squeezes. Like, Tito Ortiz is a bigger star by an order of many magnitudes over the best case for Alexander Shlemenko. Even if there's a future in Shlemenko and there's no future in Tito, I mean, to bemoan that their champion, their middleweight champion, took a ding, people aren't even going to remember who it was that Tito choked out. All people remember is that Tito won a fight again and that Tito will be back. I mean, Tito, there is a rolling clusterfuck, my man. That guy, the clusterfuck rolls on and on with Tito.
And yet they get to make a Rampage fight potentially on pay-per-view, and they have to do another pay-per-view fight since Eddie Alvarez is over to pay-per-view fight. It's exactly. Great so that Tito ended up winning. So, like, it's this perfect. Is the thing. We get all these sub-stories like, oh, well, Will Brooks won, and that sucks for Michael Chandler, but who's Eddie Alvarez going to face? He has the right to request Michael Chandler. They have to do another pay-per-view. Like, there's all these ideas bound up in it. Dude, name some outcomes for UFC 173 that make MMA feel like, oh, man, like this sport, like it's unhinged, man. Short of Dillashaw winning, which would obviously make sense.
It's not even possible, for one thing, because Bellator had two big stars that the UFC made and one dark star that Zuffa was very involved in promoting in terms of.
I would say the only outcome that could even, short of, you know, Dillashaw taking the title, the only outcome that could drum that up with the UFC, and even then, I don't know if it'd be as intense, is if Henderson locked Cormier, and people instantly, you know, look to, you know, Henderson to get the winner of Gustafson Jones, too.
Yeah.
Because it's Dan Henderson, people would, you know, Henderson's still the most well-known fighter on this card. He's still the biggest draw on this card. Yeah. That would excite and entice people, regardless of whether or not he would
get trashed. And if Robbie Lawler gets – if there's something really unique that happens and Robbie Lawler comes out with his star even more burnished than it has been by his performance against Johnny Hendricks in his UFC run. But that doesn't really change anything. That's not – I mean, there's just –
No, and that's what the Bellator card had.
This card just – the Bellator card had an advantage because it had that capital with Tito, with Rampage, and to a much lesser extent King Mo – of they were profiting off of Zuffa's old investments, you know? Who made Tito?
But the stakes Spike are higher. Zuffa. The stakes are higher, Rampage? Too. A Bellator card.
Well, sure. Exactly. Like my man Eugene Robinson said on his show, like, worst case scenario, if you lose in the UFC, you have to go to Bellator World Series of Fighting. If you lose in Bellator, where does King Mo go after the dick riding fiasco and the losses? Like, you know, I mean, what's the next move? You know, King Mo's in the press. If Bellator don't respect me, I'm going to go somewhere else. And I'm like, where is that? You know, and who wants to hire a guy who calls his boss a dick rider on live TV? Like, it's, you know, like, I want to hire this guy. Like, I want that guy representing my organization. I mean, it's just, I don't know. King Mo is a deeply fascinating character. He's the MMA Job. Except it's self-inflicted rather than, well, maybe God did take a bet with Satan and put a marker down on the wrong side of King Mo. I don't know, but I find King Mo deeply fascinating. Anyway, but look, we're talking about the Bellator pay-per-view instead of UFC 173. That says it all. I mean, there's just no juice in this orange. I mean, the fight I'm most excited about is Kikuno versus Tony Ferguson, and honestly, I think that's promotional malpractice to book that fight. Like, feed Kikuno a can, get this kid over, you know? Like, why are you throwing him to the Lions? Like,
is it the Lions though? Tony Ferguson has been incredibly hurt. He's at least got a stand-up style. Like, you know Tony Ferguson's gonna box.
As much as I love Kikuno, I don't trust the karate style against a boxing wrestler base, you know? I always feel like the boxer wrestler has a stylistic advantage. Ferguson is a tough guy at the UFC level. I mean, Kikuno's been there with Alvarez and Hung, but he hasn't faced the level of just meanness of your average UFC wrestle boxer. And
he's got the Crescent King to deliver, man.
He does, but let's give him somebody that has one UFC fight. You know, like let's.
They gave him Quinn Mulhern, and he beat the shit out of him.
He laid and prayed him. I mean, but they did that on a fight card nobody saw.
Correct.
Like, how about putting him on FS1 against somebody on their second UFC fight? You know, like, I just feel like, why are they throwing this guy into the sharks? There's this sense to me that Shelby and Joe Silva are still have that UFC versus the world mentality. So when a fighter who's been successful outside the UFC comes, let's punish this guy. Let's beat him, you know? And it's just, what are you thinking? This is your asset. Make money off of him. Build his rep.
I don't know. I think I don't know if you underrate the man himself or overrate. Like, I think Tony Ferguson, Kessler, who knows, is like a perfect, well-made little matchup.
It's a good match. It's a great match from sporting aspect. I've just been looking back at, like, what was so successful about Strikeforce? And would Scott Coker have booked this match? No. Scott Coker would have featured him against somebody. I mean, look at the way he did Nate Diaz. It was always the right fight for Nate Diaz. Was it the best sporting proposition they could get? No. But it was the best stylistic matchup to let Nate Diaz shine. And if you have a potential star, and Kikuno is somebody I think, in a small way, is a potential star. He's somebody that can be notable. He's not the Korean Zombie in terms of personality. He's got a very unique fighting style, and they're looking to expand into the Asian market. You know, what are they doing with this guy in an American card against a you know, middle of the pack, tough UFC contender? I'm just saying, you know, I think the UFC is at a plateau higher than anywhere else in the MMA world, and why throw Kikuno in that deep? I'm just saying I love Kikuno and I'm worried, Jordan. That's all I'm saying.
That's fair. If you want to use the Strikeforce example, I would say that, I mean, Strikeforce in some fashion got it right. You know, like you mentioned, like Nick Diaz.
They made something out of nothing.
Yeah, and obviously, like,
I mean,
Nick
not
Diaz,
that Nick Diaz is nothing, but they did a lot with a little. How about
well,
that?
Absolutely, dude. They turned, they got thrilling title defenses out of Nick Diaz against Marius Saromskis, a KJ Nunes rematch, a cyborg fight where Nick Diaz lost the first round, a Paul Daly fight, which is one of the best rounds in MMA history. Other than Daly and I guess Saromskis earning his shot vis-a-vis his dream run, there's not a lot of like meat and potatoes there. But it made Diaz into a star simply because people bought into the idea of the fight. And maybe there is something to be said for frequency and stakes. You know, the UFC build it up every time. Like, all right, this guy's the champion. This guy's the challenger. With Strikeforce, one of the things that I think endeared people and Pride, the same thing, and helped build an aura of invincibility and real persona around guys, as you alluded to earlier, was the fact that because Strikeforce had so few guys, and in a way, this is the same thing that informs why Bellator's last pay-per-view or any Bellator pay-per-view can potentially be huge. Because these promotions are smaller, they have fewer drawing cards. When they do a big event, they got to load them up. Or when they do regular events, they have to use these fighters more routinely. So in the case of a guy like Diaz, it means we see them more. In the case of a car or a promotion like Bellator, when they do a pay-per-view, they have to do fights where if there's an upset, the reverberations will be even bigger. If there's an insane knockout, it will be amplified because they're big fights with their major fighters that they want people to see. So a UFC card like this, even if we can recognize and appreciate that, you know, Brow Dillashaw's for all the marbles at 135. Henderson Cormier's basically a title eliminator. Lawler, Ellenberger, these guys factor in very prominently at 170.
You know, there's one angle. There's one angle that matters with the Cormier-Henderson fight. If Cormier dramatically blows his weight cut and has health problems as he did in the Olympics, then you could have something. Then you have a story. That would be big.
And that's certainly not the narrative the UFC wants.
No, that's not a good thing. But
especially,
I mean,
because it's not the kind of narrative that is going to help the fight in any way.
Oh, no. The fight might not even happen, and it would be
a
terrifying personal tragedy for Daniel Cormier. I mean, that's my worry. You know, I care about these guys as a fan and have some personal investment in them. And here's a guy who nearly killed himself with weight cuts in the Olympics. cutting weight again. And it's just, to me, how is that different than sending Chuck Liddell out there to get knocked out one more time? You know, I mean, it's like, here's a guy in his mid-30s with a family, with a future, and they're, I mean, it seems like he's done it in a responsible way. He was on the Jay Moore show or something saying he was 15 pounds over the weight limit, which is nothing for most guys, but with Cormier's history, it made me just worry a little bit, just because I'm a worrier and a negative Nancy. Anyway, that just occurred to me that was one element that could potentially make this, you know, blow up and change the landscape. But that's it.
So, I mean, it really does just make me wonder how much frequency, because like with Pratt, I always wonder, like, who knows how influential or how popular guys like Vanderlei or Krokop or Faber would be if it was the grinder every time. There's no doubt these fighters in Pride face good fighters, but they were mixed in with your Kanaharas and Shungo Oyamas and
so on. Dos Caras Jr.
Yeah, I mean, they knew how to sprinkle in a major fight, something that was actually relevant and competitive, with a couple of cans that kept the luster.
I always use the Dos Caras fight as my intro to Krokop. That always made an impression because people were focused on the wrestling mask and all that, and then the kick was so definitive, and then you show him against Krokop against a real fighter, and they were stoked, you know. And then after you show him I mean, it was like I wanted to sell Krokop Fedor to a number of people. It was easy. Show him Krokop Dos Caras, Krokop Nogueira, Krokop Fedor, boom. That's assuming they already knew about Fedor, which most of the people I was selling to did. So anyway, that's all I'm saying is, like, there is a time and a place to give a fighter a can.
I agree entirely. And if not a can, then there's times and places to allow fighters, you know,
prohibitively heavy favorite, a showcase fight. How about
that? Yeah, I mean, and that's what this TJ Dillashaw fight basically
amounts to. I shouldn't
be
calling fighters cans. That's, yeah.
No, yeah. I mean, I'm picking up what you're throwing down. That's what, yeah, like, this Dillashaw fight amounts to. TJ Dillashaw is a wonderful bantamweight, one that's still improving.
He's a placeholder.
Yeah, and, you know, similarly, Demetrius Johnson's facing Ali Bogatinov. Ali Bogatinov's the shit. He's the flyweight puncher king of Russia. But he's going to get his ass whooped by Demetrius Johnson. He still deserves his day in court, and Demetrius Johnson still deserves a chance to get a paycheck and go out, style on him for an audience, and try to keep building himself a fan base. But I think, you know, looking at Strikeforce, looking at Pride, there's just no way to deny the power of being able to show someone three or four times a year, albeit against possibly reduced opposition, but that level of frequency and potentially low stakes and more moderate matchmaking leading to stuff like Daly Diaz round one or what was Zaromskis Diaz. When you get moments like that, it really does build a star in a way that goes above and beyond, this guy's the best in the world. Because clearly that's not good enough sometimes. If it was, people would naturally react to it. Maybe they get that, you know, with a slow build over time. Maybe 2 years from now, Demetrius Johnson and Hayden Barrow are still taking fools out. You know, we get them at 135 and it's splendid.
I mean, if who's the best fighter was going to tell you who sold the most fights, then the Best Picture Award would tell you what was going to be the highest grossing picture. It's two different discussions, and I'm not even getting into the whole thing of whether or not the best Picture Oscar means anything. I'm just saying it's two different things. There's quality and there's marketability, and the two very rarely meet in the middle.
They very rarely meet in the middle, but one place they do is the work of old Nate Wilcox. Read the man on bloodyelbow.com and follow this man on Twitter at Kidney.
Nudge, elbow, punch, kick, step on somebody's laptop. Whatever you have to do to get a seat in Press Row, Wednesdays on the SureDog.com blog.